signs of life. Please don't tell me that the human race did not survive.
There are no people in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey everybody, welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our call-in show for Monday, March 22nd, 2021. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and across the country. On Fridays, that's our flagship show. Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics in our news roundup. You can get both by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can only, however, call in on the call-in show by downloading the Podbean app and logging in and checking us out through there. We might have some programmatic changes coming up in the weeks to come. We might kind of shift away from that a little bit. I'll tell you a little bit about that in some of the weeks to come. Yet we're testing out some different platforms, but I'll talk about that kind of coming up. But anyways, we broadcast normally on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can also jump on our live stream over on our YouTube channel. And if you got listening on the Podbean app right now and you haven't kind of subscribed to us or liked us over on the YouTube channel, make sure you head on over there, hit that nice subscribe button, smash that bell to make sure that you get notifications every time we go live, and make sure to like the stream. That's how we kind of amplify the messages that we get on this podcast and help more people find our show. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show live on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right now. Yeah, you can drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking on that little gift icon at the bottom of the screen or top of your screen. I guess it's based upon your phone. I've been told, at least, that that little gift icon is in different places. So look for the gift icon. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. You can also help on the show. Like I said, head on over to our YouTube channel and make sure you smash that subscribe button, like the stream for the show, and hit that notification bell. And if you're looking for some more PA-based progressive talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channels, Twitter, Facebook, basically anywhere you got a stream going, you can find Rick's show at 9 p.m. I also should say, in the coming weeks, we've got some exciting new podcasts that are coming out that we're working on networking with. And I don't want to kind of jump the gun and step on someone else's line, so to speak. So I'll wait a little bit to announce for some guests on that one. But it's some really, really cool stuff coming up. Anyways, for all our gamers out there, I want to introduce you to the go-to place for all your gaming needs. Check out The Game Inn, located right on Route 309 in Quakertown, PA. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, Black family-owned gaming store. And the folks who own it happen to be the parents of one of my son's best friends, who's just an awesome family, great folks, kind of local folks, kind of making an amazing game shop over there. So not only, you know, they're friends of the show. They've got everything you're going to look for in terms of, you know, your gaming needs, retro N64s, Nintendo DSs, PS4s, and the Switches. They got it all. They got a variety of video games for all platforms, large collections of collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, literally like a wall of Funko Pops like along there. Like, I'm always worried, like, when I go in there, I'm like, is this safe? Just kidding, it's all great. Nicholas, one of the owners of the shop, just absolutely loves them, and he's a collector. So and if you got kids get discounts with every A on the report card. So check them out on their Facebook page. That's The Game Inn with two N's. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn with two N's. If you've got a question about a game, looking for something hard to get, just message them on Facebook or drop them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com. That's The Game Inn with two A's, pa@gmail.com, or check them out at thegameinn.com. Special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at Song of Day Man. Again, two N's, at Song of Day Man on Twitter. And a special shout out and an apology. We had a little bit of a rough start on Friday to the show. We've been hammering out some technical things. And in the midst of all that, I kind of rushed through the intro. So I didn't give the shout outs on Friday, is what I'm going to give them tonight. Special shout out to our new patrons from March. That's Brian, Jude, and to our newest patron, Janet, who joined a little over a week ago at the $5 a month level. And not only is she the newest patron, but if I've got this right, she's our first Canadian patron. Yes, that's right. First Canadian patron, Great White North. I'm loving it. Welcome to our growing Raging Chicken Patreon community, Janet. And thank you all who've supported the show right from the beginning, all throughout, or who've thrown us a few bucks here and there for what you can get in. But, you know, most of all, those folks who actually share our content too as well. You know, right now, if you're listening on Podbean, you're watching this on YouTube right now, share it out to your friends, share it to your social media, help kind of get the word out and get some other folks, other voices on the show. A couple programming notes before we kind of jump into tonight's show. This week, we'll have our regular show on Friday. Next Monday's Out to Coop Live is probably going to be a replay. Not going to be able to do the show next Monday night. And next Friday, too, as well, may be a replay, too. I'll keep you posted on our social media sites. But I'll probably have some relevant content. I'm thinking about replaying next week a show that I did a kind of a few weeks back on more on Poshy stuff. Given the fact that this is all coming to a head, as it were. So on tonight's show, as you may have guessed from the title of our show, we're looking at some of the challenges, the crises, the threats that are facing either individual universities or the entire state system of higher education. This is, again, for those folks who are kind of listening to us from outside of the state, PASHE is the PA State System of Higher Education, although they like to be called SS, just state system, at state system. But it's the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. It's a 14 state-owned university system in the state of Pennsylvania. Well, last week, on Thursday, I believe it was, during the Senate appropriation hearings for public higher education, Dan Greenstein, who's the chancellor, he kind of dropped a bombshell, right? In response to a question that he got from State Senator Joe Pittman. If you go listen to our discussion back on Friday, or I actually did I clipped it out and threw it up on our YouTube page, my little commentary on it for Friday, you can go back and take a look at that. But the short of it is, was very much, as Sean was making the case, very much of the kind of question that was asked to him that was, you know, sent ahead of time, right? It was a question that was prepared. The chancellor knows this kind of question is coming. More likely than not, that's a question that came out of the chancellor's office to State Senator Joe Pittman, who represents the area around Indiana University in Indiana County. Senator Pittman, State Senator Pittman asked him this question, and Chancellor Greenstein responds with this. So I'm just going to play the sound just so that for those folks who weren't listening to the show on Friday may not have heard the sound yet, just so you got a sense. So I'm not just characterizing the exchange, but you can hear it firsthand. So this is the intro. The first voice you're going to hear is State Senator Joe Pittman, and then you're going to hear Chancellor Greenstein's response to Senator Joe Pittman's, which has caused quite an uproar throughout the state. So here you go.
That's where I'm struggling at this point, Chancellor, because I'm wondering what the value add of being part of the state system even is at this point.
So, Senator, unless we figure this out, I will be recommending to the board that we come back to the Senate next year with a legislative package to dissolve the system, because if we continue to go down this path, what you're going to see is that cross-subsidization is going to drain all of us. Well, and then what does that mean for public higher education in this state?
My time is short, but I'll be more than happy to be the sponsor of that bill, because I'm watching a president of a university try very hard to make it work in a collective bargaining agreement that he didn't negotiate with universities.
Okay. So what you hear there is a couple contexts. This guy represents Indiana County. He's out talking about Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Indiana University of Pennsylvania is facing a large number of faculty cuts, including faculty with tenure. Of course, the story of Indiana University made it in the kind of the pages of the New York Times, long profile piece about what it looks like to turn to austerity measures and to kind of deal with what's happening in public higher education right now. Very much off in the wake of the coronavirus and the pandemic, it's been the pandemic has been used very often as an easy way to sidestep some issues about kind of long-term funding gaps and so on as a way to kind of talk about crisis and that's going on. Now, what's happening at Indiana University, Pennsylvania, these large faculty cuts, what State Senator Pittman said there was basically, look, I'm looking at this university president, president of IUP, trying real hard and failing, right, to do this and now facing all these cuts because of these problems in the state state system of higher education. And what you heard Chancellor Greenstein say there is this kind of this cross-funding, right? And basically what he means is as a 14-state university system, right, the idea is that there's some universities that are going to have higher enrollments and can be in higher demand, and other ones that are located throughout the state that are not going to have that same kind of enrollments and may have actually experienced some demographic challenges, some demographic downturns of either kind of recently or over a period of time. And the idea is that, okay, that you make sure that the state system is healthy as a whole, so the funding gets spread out kind of across the system, right? You make sure the entire system is healthy. So what they're talking about here is the what they're calling a redistribution of funds from the healthy schools, right? Like at least what Pittman's suggesting is IUP, to the unhealthy schools, right? Like Mansfield and Lock Haven, right? And Edinburgh, right? That's the at least the claims that are being made here. Okay, so you can see how this plays into a discourse of, you know, that is very familiar in our kind of neoliberal era, right? About that, you know, the people who are doing well should keep what they've got and they shouldn't have to pay the price of the rest of them. They shouldn't have to kind of hand over the money that they earned fair and square to those folks who are not pulling their weight. I mean, that's the discourse, right? So... Remember a few years back, there was Andy Dinneman, who's a representative or senator, state senator from down by Westchester, was pushing this plan to have Westchester University secede from the state system, right? Made this kind of big splash and was a way of kind of dramatizing the exact same issue. Why should Westchester, one of the healthiest, you know, quote unquote, healthiest universities in the state system, why should they have to share their abundance? Why should Westchester have to pay the price for those folks out in Mansfield, out in Lock Haven, out in Edinburgh, out in Clarion? Why should they have to pay the price because they're not working hard enough or whatever it might be, right? Now, again, they never say these things explicit, right? But that's always like what's right under the surface here, right? So that's where we were last week. You may have heard me also talk about in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, right after I'm sure he wishes, or I'm sure he's got higher aspirations than that, but right after Chancellor Greenstein had a Zoom town hall at Kutztown University. And there was this moment in the town hall that just leapt kind of like off the screen at me. And that's when, and I wish I had audio for you to hear this, because I tried to track it down, tried to find somebody that had the audio or had the video of that Zoom call. I have not been successful in getting it yet, but as soon as I do get that audio, I'm sure somebody has it. Just a matter of kind of finding the right person who's got that audio. I'll play that for you too as well, so you can hear it in full context. So I'm just going to give you my read of it. So at one point, there are several questions that come from students about access to mental health services, about a kind of a racist cop on campus, a bunch of that kind of stuff. But there's a larger discussion that's happening about the quote unquote financial health of the state system. And there's been concern at Kutztown University campus about the possibility that Kutztown might get merged to like East Stroudsburg or something like this. And I know our local ABSCUF, that's the faculty union president, has been continuing to ask that question. And a lot hasn't come back, right? You know, no, it's not going to happen. But those concerns came up, and Greenstein seemed to say again that no, that's not going to happen to Kutztown, at least at this point. So kind of no worries there. And Hawkinson seemed to affirm this. And then it got into some of these other kind of funding questions, and Greenstein got kind of frustrated at one point at the continued, you know, the persistence of these questions about like lack of funding and so on. And he said, look, our idea was to grow, right, out of scarcity, right? So in other words, instead of cutting our way out, we're going to grow our way out. We're going to innovate, and we're going to have these innovations. And these innovations are going to cause us to grow, and that's going to bring in more revenue, and therefore that everything's going to be successful, right? And he, of course, is the innovator in chief in this storyline. Remember, Chancellor Greenstein came from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's higher ed division, where he was responsible of, you know, rolling out a whole bunch of these kind of, you know, tech-friendly, Silicon Valley-esque, innovate-your-way-out, win-win scenarios to make everything better. Well, we also know that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, there's a report that came out last year about all their educational experiments, and none of them worked. They spent millions and millions of dollars to have any kind of negligible result. You'd see a little bit tweaks here, some successes, other places there were failures. They found it was basically all a wash. So they spent like hundreds of billions of dollars to fundamentally change the way directions of higher education to have virtually no result. But the people who work in education, whether it's K through 12 teacher or in higher ed, had their lives materially impacted by this push towards assessment, this push towards numbers, this push towards kind of innovations by working harder without sufficient resources, right? And of course, what's always right behind, you know, that idea about innovation has always been austerity, job cuts, doing more with less, and then putting things on online, right? The whole idea of like, oh, you've got a problem accessing mental health services? There's an app for that. Oh, you've got problems dealing with the kind of the racism you're experiencing every day on your campus? Oh, there's an app for that. Oh, what's wrong? Black mold in your office building? Oh, there's an app for that. Like somehow that we're gonna look to the bright, shiny technology solutions, the technological solutions, the Silicon Valley-esque solutions, that word of innovation is gonna kind of, you know, like solve our problems. Well, that didn't quite work, but he got frustrated in this conversation. And what he said is like, you know, look, we wanted to innovate our way out and grow our way out. We got to do what they did in the tech industry, right? And this is what took me back. He said, what they learn in the industry is you fail fast and you learn and you change. You experiment wildly. You fail fast, you learn, and you update, and then you do it again, right? And two things that happen. I've plugged this on the show so many times. And I butcher the guy's name every single time, and I apologize for this. There's a great book called Winners Take All by Anand Giridharadas, Giridharadas. That's it, Giridharadas. Anand Giridharadas, his book, Winners Take All. It's a guy who's had a kind of a unique internal perspective. You know, he's in that whole kind of TED Talk circuit and everything like this. His internal perspective on this kind of innovation culture and this whole idea about thought leadership that is specifically the kind that comes out from the philanthropic world and from the kind of like Silicon Valley version of that world, right? And in that book, he lays out the discourse, right? And that, you know, the emptiness of that discourse that sounds bright and shiny, but in the end, it means job loss and people at the bottom pay the price, right? So think about the difference between a taxi driver and Uber driver, right? On the one hand, the Uber app is like spectacular because, you know, even if you can't get a taxi, you've got this and you could call up an Uber and then they're going to come and get you. And it's so cool with this, you know, little app. You don't even need to exchange money because it's all there on the app and the person is friendly and all that. But as we've learned over the years, that app, that kind of solution has started to put, you know, family sustaining taxi driver jobs like out of business. Right. And the algorithm that Uber now uses for compensation and whether or not a person kind of continue to get jobs, you know, it squeezes the drivers more and more. So the people who own the app, who have nothing to do with the actual work going on with the Uber drivers, that they can reap more profit for the shareholders. Right. That's the model. Right. So we see that there's an app for that therefore replaces kind of work. This is the kind of thing that we see. So when he said fail fast, we're going to innovate, fail, like experiment widely, fail fast, learn, and then do it all over again. And I'm just thinking, you know, I read that book on the one hand, and I'm also, because I'm a space geek, I watch all the SpaceX launches, right? And watch Elon Musk and his kind of like eternal man boy, like, you know, company crash all these rockets, right? And using that logic of kind of fail fast, smash up the rocket, learn from the data, and then kind of redo it over again. Now, all credit due, that model has been extraordinarily like successful in a very specific realm, right? When you're talking about stuff, right, it can be very successful. Right. If you look at what SpaceX has done in terms of the cost of like the cost of space travel, right, and a kind of like satellites, reusable rockets, all that kind of stuff, you can make a case that that's a model that works, right? But it doesn't necessarily work when you're dealing with human beings. It works for rockets, right? It doesn't so much work for human beings, because the people who are on the receiving end of the fail fast, the innovate, fail fast, crash and redo it again, those are teachers, secretaries, custodial workers, groundskeepers, members of the community, students, they're real people. And that's the kind of, you know, the, and there's multiple books you can kind of read about this. I got this great book that just came in the mail today. It's called Fulfillment. It's on Amazon's model of exactly what's this done with labor and work. But it's the same principle. So say that's that model. And so when I read kind of Anand Giridharadas's book, Winners Take All, and see that discourse. And then the first time I ever saw Chancellor Greenstein come and speak at Kutztown, I had just finished that book, walked into this, you know, this is before COVID, walked in this auditorium, listened to him speak, and I'm like, oh my God. It's like, there it is. I just read about this, and there he is performing it. And I'm looking around, and to this day, I've been surprised at the number of academics who work in higher education who have no idea about that guy's book. Right. And so, you know, whatever, it's happened in my little quirk of what I study, right, and what I look at, what I read. But that was, blows my mind. So I'm like, hey, you know this guy's book? And they're like, no, I don't know this guy. But you know this guy? They're like, no. Like, and I've been hawking this dude's book for, you know, for years now, for a couple of years at least, three maybe years now, because it speaks directly to this issue that we kind of see with this chancellor. So he says that at Kutztown, the fail fast, crash hard. Then we see this piece that happens here at the State System of Higher Education's appropriations here in the State Senate, Pennsylvania State Senate. And at that same hearing, this has got far less attention. And I know I'm talking a lot here at the beginning of the show. I do want to, you know, say, look, if you're interested in participating, you can throw comments in the chat right now. If you're on the Podbean app, you can throw comments in the chat on their YouTube channel. Thank you all for tuning and listening, especially those folks on YouTube. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you hit that kind of like the stream, and make sure you ring that bell so you know every time that we go live. But because I do want to get to here, if people got calls, you want to call in on the Podbean app. I'll get to that in kind of like in a little bit. And if you want to have comments you want to right now, you can throw them in the chat and we can kind of start including in the conversation now. Anyhow, so there's another piece to just in terms, like I study rhetoric, right? So this is kind of a rhetorical move that is made by the chancellor in that appropriation hearing that I thought was once brilliant and absolutely insidious. Okay. Now, so remember how I started the discussion tonight, right? Really talking about this whole idea about, you know, how those, you know, those smaller colleges that are not pulling their weight, right? And how that, why should the successful have to pay the price and share what they've reaped, right? That's the same logic. So this is, I'm going to have two pieces of sound here that I'll play kind of, and there's a gap in between that in the actual, in terms of if you listen to the entire thing, it's a little bit of a gap where it goes in a different direction. But I want you to hear first from State Senator Vincent Hughes. State Senator Vincent Hughes he was there basically at the founding of the state system. His father was intimately involved in bringing or, you know, creating the state system of higher education. Right, because remember, it used to be a series of teachers' colleges dispersed throughout the state. Right, and the idea was when those teachers' colleges were founded, to make sure that they were dispersed evenly across the state in rural areas and urban areas and everywhere in between, because you wanted to make sure that every region had affordable, high quality access to public higher education, right? That was the whole mission. So State Senator Vincent Hughes is very often one of the people that is most vociferously defending PASHE, State System of Higher Education, right? And so this first piece of sound I want to play here is State Senator Vincent Hughes talking about the purpose of the State System of Higher Education. All right, so here he is at the Senate appropriation hearings.
I also feel compelled to remind members, members that if they say they are concerned or committed to a low-cost, high-quality option for Pennsylvania students to have to go to college, fundamentally is the state system of higher education. It's our system. If members are committed to that notion, low cost meaning accessible, high quality meaning that it meets the needs of 21st century reality, we have the state system. That's what it was created for. And that's what it was designed as a system for, especially in those far-off communities in Pennsylvania. You know, those distant communities in Pennsylvania, those rural communities in Pennsylvania, they need a strong university for their residents, but they also need those strong universities because of the economic impact that they have for those communities. Far-off places, strong university, economic, cultural, intellectual drivers in those areas. Absolutely necessary. So that's what the system was created for. Low cost, high quality options for Pennsylvania residents, and to strengthen those universities, especially in rural communities, so they could remain pillars in those communities to be drivers for those communities. That's what the system was created for.
Okay, so there we have it, right? Senator Hughes has told this story. He could probably tell this story kind of like in a half sleep, right? I mean, he is that kind of advocate for the state system of higher education and articulates it there perfectly. The whole idea was to ensure the system's health, to make sure that everybody, especially in underserved rural communities, would get that access to affordable, high quality public education, right? Now, of course, at the same time, right, that was also true kind of around urban areas, right? But the recognition, of course, is that the areas that are going to be most difficult, financially sustainable, are going to be areas with smaller populations, right? I mean, that just kind of like makes sense. If you're in an area with like a million people, right, there's a lot more potential students who are going to do that. If you look at Westchester University, I mean, you're on a train line to Philly, right? So, but if you're in Mansfield, right, at the very top of the state, right, kind of center east north, right, it's way up. It's a gorgeous area, absolutely gorgeous. Same with Lock Haven. You've got a lower population, right? So you're necessarily going to have a smaller school. But you want to make sure that you've got that comprehensive education there, right? So that's what Hughes is laying out. So there's another story that it just the discussion of this in the appropriation hearing was a little bit lengthy and was hard to clip out in some way. So I'm going to try to summarize it just very briefly, and I'm not going to go into the details because it's a really complex kind of story that's all multifaceted. But let me just say this: Cheney University, right, is a historically Black college, right? Black college university, HCBU. It is a part of the state system of higher education. It is one of, if not the oldest, right, in the country, HBCU. And Cheney was on the brink of, say, bankruptcy. Okay, I hesitate to use that word because there was a lot of issues that were going on, what was happening with money, with some of the administration. There had been historical neglect of Cheney, both from the state system of higher education and from the Pennsylvania as a whole, especially state legislatures. There have been, of course, the historic kind of racist histories that have confronted Cheney, right? That have exacerbated the funding kind of issues there. And it's always been a, not always been, but it has been one of one of the schools in the states of higher education that has not been, I think, adequately addressed until, you know, in terms of like funding and kind of the history and the importance of it until relatively recently. That is, you know, no fault of the faculty members that have been, and the students who have gone to Cheney, who have fought for that school for like generations, okay? So there, but nonetheless, there had been a real kind of financial issue going on at kind of Cheney, right? For, again, complicated reasons that maybe we'll get into at some point. I'll have somebody come on and talk about. There's some really good writing out there about it and some good interviews with it that I'll kind of point you all to in the coming weeks. So there's the issue of Cheney. Now, Vincent Hughes, right, same guy, has also been a champion of Cheney, like over the years. He's also been someone who's insisted that we remember like the history, like the historic importance of that being the only HCBU in the state system of higher education, the kind of the storied history of Cheney, right? What it means in the kind of like the history of the region, particularly in kind of African-American communities, right? And why we should be seeing this as like, you know, basically like a historic landmark that we should be investing in like nobody's business. Instead, we've chosen to let Cheney kind of wither on the vine. And I say we, and I'm using the we kind of in a broad sense here. So what happens at this point? So Vincent Hughes talks about the importance of what the meaning of the state system is. There's a little bit of back and forth here about Cheney, right? Because Greenstein introduces Cheney and basically says, yeah, like, you know, but we helped out, we did Cheney, and Cheney had to go through some hard times, right? Then Senator Hughes talks a little bit more about Cheney and kind of trying to make a distinction between what was happening at Cheney and what's happening in terms of the chancellor's plans for merger, the Northeast mergers and the Northwest mergers, right? Looking at those two mergers as kind of wanting to kind of conflate them, right? So what the chancellor does here, and I was actually back and forth with Sean Kitchen. He and I were kind of on Twitter back and forth while we were listening to the appropriations hearing. And this is something that I flagged immediately. And I was like, did you just hear what just happened? And I don't know what's in Senator Hughes's mind, but what I saw his reaction was a little bit like, whoa, what did this guy just do? So Senator Hughes lays out what goes on, what the state system is all about, making sure that everybody has access. You have a strong system to make sure that nobody is underserved. Right. And to Greenstein's credit, right, he does point to one of the main causes of the problems we're facing now is the historic underfunding of the state system of higher education and the budget cuts that have taken place over the past three decades, which is on both the Republicans and the Democrats and in the PA state legislature. Right. So to his credit on that, right, he does call that out, which is good. Doesn't say that that's the solution, but whatever. So here's what he does. Now, watch this rhetorical move. State Senator Vincent Hughes, he's African-American. He comes out in defense of the state system of higher education. And Greenstein comes in as like Chancellor woke. Right? He's going to show that he's more woke than Vincent Hughes. Right? Chancellor McDreamy is going to be more woke than Vincent Hughes. Watch this little turn that he does. And then I want to talk about the racial implications of this move. Okay, so this is Chancellor Greenstein responding to Senator Hughes.
So from the very beginning, if I may, you know, integration, system redesign was introduced as an opportunity to innovate in the interest of growth. Yeah, we have financial problems, financial sustainability. I'm going to go back to Cheney, right? Shrink to grow. I think something that you said to me. We learned a lot from Cheney, you know, and in fact, Senator, if I can say this, A, you were right. But, you know, more importantly, and I don't remember, when was the commission? You know, Cheney was, you know, experiencing serious challenges, declining finances, challenges with student outcomes. And there was a commission that was established, and I believe you were on it and others. And President Walton was appointed to really begin a kind of a long-range process turnaround. He's done a heck of a job. And now, honestly, Senator, learning from that lesson, we're doing the same thing at other institutions which are having that same experience. And it just seems to me, I'm sorry, but it's unconscionable that we should. That's okay for Cheney. Why isn't that okay for other institutions in the system? That's what we're doing. And look at what's happening at Cheney. Right? They got a long way to go. You know that. You're a member of the Council of Trustees. But they're on a path to growth. They're not going to be a 15,000 university, you know, student university. And the path that they're on is fundamentally different from the one they left. And they've made that shift. They're almost existence proof that we can do this, that public higher education has another path. And the point that I've made is simply, we have got to get on another path. We cannot continue to draw down on the whole in the way that we're doing. And we can't have expectations of Cheney that we're not willing to have of other universities in the system.
And there it is. I'm sorry for a couple cutouts there. There was a kind of a buffering problem when I was recording it. So that's where you hear those little cutouts there. So did you get that? So what Chancellor Greenstein does, right, is his response to Vincent Hughes is to basically critique Hughes's thing by basically saying, if we made Cheney go through this kind of like tough love, this austerity, this shrink to grow, which was one of Senator Hughes's arguments about saving Cheney, if we're not going to apply the same metric, right, the shrink to grow, to fundamental change at Mansfield and Lock Haven, what effectively the Chancellor is saying, isn't that racist? He says it's unconscionable that we would make Cheney do something that we're not willing to make Mansfield and Lock Haven do. Let that sit with you for a second. So one of the most strongest proponents of the HBCU in the state, of the state system of higher education, of African-American interests, right, come out of Philadelphia, Vincent Hughes, right? He's being disciplined by the chancellor by saying that, hey, I understand your point, but if we're not willing to make the rural white schools do the same thing as the urban black school, that's unconscionable because that's essentially racist. And that blew my mind. And he does it with a smile and like with grace. I hate that freaking word as it applies in this kind of context, but in such a way that, like I said, I don't know. I haven't talked to Senator Hughes. I don't know if this is true or not. But it seemed like it took him back a little bit. That the chancellor would pull that. And what it essentially does then, it reinforces and reinscribes the antagonism between white rural and urban people of color. And he's utilizing that divide as a means to gain approval of his package of Pennsylvania's system of higher education redesign, which includes the merger of Lock Haven University, Mansfield University, and Bloomsburg University in the east, and Edinburgh University, Clarion University, and California University in the west. The elimination, as we heard on Out to Coop Live last week, we had the folks on from Lock Haven, the elimination of over 40 faculty jobs, over 55 staff jobs. The borough of Lock Haven, they passed unanimous kind of like resistance to what the chancellor was doing because they know it's going to have a devastating impact on their local economy. Same is true in Mansfield. But now he's saying, and there's another clip that I didn't pull out for tonight, which is just as harsh, basically saying, look, what most people understand is that we have to do this. And he basically calls those people at Lockhaven people who just don't understand. They just don't get it. They don't understand. They must be dumb because he's the smart guy, right? This is that discourse that I was talking about. It's a discourse that is clothed in wokeness, but it is devastatingly about austerity. And it's about this whole concept, the same principle that we see coming out of Silicon Valley, innovation because it's cool and we can do something really different and it's exciting for those people who are working on it at the top. It's devastating for people who rely upon those thing at the bottom. That's what we're dealing with, in my humble opinion. Right? So anyways, I want to make sure we have time. If anybody wants to call, anybody wants to kind of add their two cents, I'd be happy to start taking calls right after the break. Anybody who wants to chime in, all you do, if you're logged into the Podbean app, in order to kind of call in, you need to be kind of in the Podbean app, and you'll see these little kind of call buttons. Most of the time, they appear at the top. Every once in a while, I've heard people tell me that they appear at the bottom. But you say, call line one, call line two. You call in, I'll see you, and I can answer the call and love to hear kind of what your thoughts are. That's where we're at. But we'll take a quick break just based to say you can support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/rcpress. Or if you're listening to us during this show on the Podbean app, you can click that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen and send us a virtual cup of coffee, a love balloon, some roses, or even a golden mic. Get yourself some golden beans. That's what Podbean calls them. And send the love. All the gifts that you send us during the show and afterwards, for that matter, help support expand this podcast. We'd also know you head on over to our YouTube channel. That's at Raging Chicken Media, Raging Chicken Media over on YouTube. You can kind of like us there. Like this stream. That helps get it out. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. We're just kind of approaching our 100 subscribers. And I know that by comparison, based on what my kids watch, right? That's like nothing. They kind of laugh at me for it. But for me, it's something, you know? It helps kind of expand and kind of, you know, give a little signal boost to the folks we get on this show. People like, you know, we've heard, we had Representative Elizabeth Fiedler and State Senator Nikhil Saval on a couple of weeks ago. We had just this past week, oh my God, absolutely kind of amazing interview, probably the best interview that I've ever done this past Wednesday with Christina Marusik from the Environmental Health News on her report on the chemicals in people's bodies as a result of fracking. We've had, you know, Rick Kujewski on the show. We've had, and I see Shana right here on the show before. We've had, you know, some great folks. So you go on over, subscribe to us on YouTube. That helps other people see the show. That helps give a signal boost to all the great work that people are that come on the show. And we've got some great stuff that are coming up in the weeks to come too as well. So please, anybody, if you have anything that you kind of want to chime in about, you have a comment, you have a question, you could even put it in the chat, or you can actually throw it or in the chat on YouTube, throw it in the chat on Podbean, or you can call in through the Podbean app. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. And I said one of the things that and I'm just going to continue to talk, but don't hesitate. If you got something to say, just call in and I'll shut my mouth, right? Because, you know, I'm an academic and a kind of whatever, kind of a loudmouth agitator. So it's, you know, my mouth can just ramble for on, like on and on. So just stop me, please. Mm. One of the things that got passed to me, this is just came to me about a week and a half ago. And this, let me step back one bit. One of the complaints that has come out, especially when it comes to these mergers, let's be fair, right? We can say that this question of what to do about declining enrollments at some of the smaller colleges is a big one, right? It's a real one. But let's also be clear that the reason why we're in this problem is because our state legislature has underfunded PASHE consistently and persistently over, you know, since the 80s, right? There's, you know, this famous, I should say since the 90s, really. When States of Higher Education was first founded, right, roughly 65% of the cost to attend the school came from, you know, taxes, right? Came from our kind of contributions, came from the state appropriation. So about, what's that work about? 35% or 30%, I think it was a little lower than that, but came from students and families, right? And that's exactly what made it, you know, affordable, right? If you look at that same graph now, right, state appropriations versus contributions of students and their families, it's flipped, except it's flipped and exacerbated. And what do I mean by that? It means that now about 75% of the cost of attending one of the state system schools is borne by students and their families, while only about 25%, even maybe even less in some models, is coming from the state. And, you know, we've had Democratic governors, we've had Republican governors, right? There's been, you know, there's been Democrats who have been in charge, there's been Republicans who have been in charge. And the trend has been the defunding, the slow defunding and bleeding of public higher education. Right? We know, like, remember Ed Rendell, good old Ed Rendell, Democratic Party Ed Rendell, was one of the worst, right, in seeking out public-private partnerships and enforcing on kind of austerity measures, right? But that's been the trend. And so right now, so it makes sense why Pennsylvania also, again, it depends on the studies that you look for. Anywhere, we're either like number two or number five or somewhere in between of the most student debt of any state in the country, right? There's a correlation there, right? It's not exactly one-to-one, but you do the math, right? So we've got heavy student debt burden, right? We've got, we rank, again, depending on which study you're looking at, we have 49th, some say 47th in the country in terms of state support for public higher education. So it's clear who bears the responsibility here, right? It's not because students have become lazy. It's not because people have become unwilling to kind of like keep up with the cost of higher education. It's not because, you know, the computers, right? That's my favorite one. It's the computers did it, right? It's the computers. Like, again, those are costs. Those are real costs, right? Student, you know, they had to get computers and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, whatever. But you know what's not an, like, educational necessity? Luxury suite dorms are not, right? State-of-the-art rock climbing walls, not, right? Luxury workout centers, not. And again, I don't mean to say that we shouldn't have these things, right? Or that we shouldn't consider those things, right? But nonetheless, how about a new, like, portico for the administration building at Kutztown University, several million dollar job, so that you had a nice looking entranceway? Necessity? I don't know. These are choices. These are budgetary choices. This is why on this program and very often in the union, we talk about the budget is a moral document, right? Why is it a moral document? Because the budget is essentially a wish list of what we want to do. So it's all about choices. And the budget is not the same as the actuals, right? The actual money that comes in and leaves, that's one thing. The budget does not necessarily correspond with that, right? We uncovered this at Kutztown. You've heard me talk about this like till I'm blue in the face. In any context, I'll talk about this, about how the budget at Kutztown University, at several of the universities, was actually actively manipulated to basically show us that we are constantly in crisis, even though we've had one of the highest, say, pools of money, like unrestricted net assets, we call them, right, of all the state system schools. Now, that's changed a little bit, in part because of the economic crash and then because we're having the pandemic and some, I would argue, bad choices being made by the administration, but we'll get behind that. So anyways, there's all that kind of stuff in the background. So that budget stuff and those choices, blah, blah, blah. What I wanted to get to there is that when we're making these choices, you know, we got to think about what kind of future we want. We got to think about and who's to blame right? Because who causes the problem should determine, in my view, at least in part, maybe not entirely, but at least in part, like, who's also going to be the one taking up the, you know, the highest amount of the load, is going to carry the most water for the solution, right? But what's happened is then the people who are going to pay the price, the people who are going to kind of like get us out of the situation, it's constantly being put on faculty, staff, and students, and their families, of course. We're asked to do more with less. I mean, you've heard it all. You know what I'm talking about. We're asked to kind of innovate our way out of with no support. I was just reading an email chain from Kutztown University today about they're having a difficulty fulfilling the directorship for the Frederick Douglass Institute. Why? Because there's no support for it. That you're basically asking faculty members to kind of like, okay, do it because you agree with it, right? Be the monk, right? Be the nun, right? Take your vow of poverty, like throw yourself and your suffering onto the rock because for the good of the cause. Do it because you love it. We're not going to support you for it. Your love will carry you through. There's a great book, by the way, by Sarah Jaffe, which I was posting about and talked a little bit about on the show a couple weeks back. Sarah Jaffe's book, phenomenal book called Work Won't Love You Back. Mandatory reading for absolutely everybody. It's a spectacular book, Work Won't Love You Back, and it's exactly about this stuff. And they use our love for what we do as a way of getting us to collaborate with their austerity. Because we love our jobs, because we love to teach, we love learning, we love reading, we love thinking, we love sharing that knowledge and that experience of it. Because of that, they will use that love against us. That they know that we'll say, because I love this, I'll do a little bit more for less. Sure, I'll do that extra work and I won't ask any for any additional compensation or pay. Sure, I'll take a few more students in my classes. Right? It's sad. So Shane even says right here in the talks, like, you know, thank you for saying that about the funding stuff, right? So if they would fund it, you know, her kids could actually be able to afford to go there. This is supposed to be the affordable option in the state. This is supposed to be high quality, affordable education, right? This is why, you know, you heard me on my rant from Thursday, from last Friday's podcast, or you can see the clip on YouTube. When the Student Power Network, right, the Pennsylvania Student Power Network, when that was allowed to crumble, we lost one of the biggest potential assets in the struggle and the fight for real affordable education, free college education. But, you know, sometimes petty things win out. So that's kind of where we're at. So there's some things. So what I wanted to get to, too, is, like, again, remind everybody, if you've got comments, you got questions, feel free to call in. Feel free to leave your comment. I'd be happy to address it either way. I'd love to hear your thoughts and kind of your perspective and your, you know, your angle on things from where you see it. If you've been impacted by this one way or another, you're thinking about public higher education, or maybe you don't give a crap at all. You're like, whatever, let it burn. I don't know, right? Maybe you're just interested in yourself, right? You just say, what about me? As long as I'm going to be fine, I don't care about Lock Haven. As long as my experience is going to be fine, I really don't care about Mansfield. As long as my kid can get to school, you know, so what if other kids have to take on debt? I mean, I don't know. That's not me. That's not my set of values. I know that. So this is like probably about a week and a half ago. This shows you how some of the process stuff, okay? So one of the biggest complaints that came out of Lock Haven and has come out of the merger plans out in the West too as well, has been the chancellor has outright refused to answer specific questions. Right. About a whole range of impacts. Right. And what's interesting to see the trajectory of those questions, I think initially there was there was a lot of faculty members who wanted to play ball, right? Who did the things that faculty always do, right? And again, listen to my rant if you want to. What they did is they said, okay, you seem to be educated. You seem to be kind of like, you know, one of us. You kind of got that liberal kind of like sensibility. So maybe you'll be better. We'll work with you because you seem to want to work with each other. You seem to want to work with us. Okay, great. And so faculty start putting in the work, right, for free to see what they can see what they can do. Because he's saying they want in, he wants input, and he's going to listen, and he's a data-driven guy and all this other kind of stuff. So he's going to listen. He's going to hear everybody. We're going to kind of do this together. That was the whole posture that got us through our first contract, right, with him. Right. And I remember saying at the time, I said, this dude, he is setting us up. He's playing good boy for until we get that contract. And then he brings down the hammer. And sure enough, here we go. Anyways. So, you know, faculty start doing it. And then they have some, you know, some basic questions. I remember some of the first ones that really I started kind of like seeing come back and again and people raising some really kind of, you know, raised eyebrows about was they asked like simple questions about what happens to sports teams. Right? Because the NCAA, they accredit programs by the university. Right? So either you're going to have accredited programs of like, either like Mansfield, Lock Haven, and Bloomsburg are one university, and they're all going to be accredited on the NCAA. So there'll be one football team, there'll be one baseball team right across the board. Right? Or these are going to be like what, branch campuses? And those branch campuses aren't going to get NCAA accreditation. So the head campus of those three will be the one with the accreditation of sports teams. And then they were saying, like, even like, well, how do we talk about naming? What about the naming of the sports teams? And at first, the chancellor was like, oh, no, that's not going to be affected. But when people started, you know, doing little things like talking to the people at the NCAA because they're in conversation with them anyways. Hey, just by the way, I'm going to float this by you. What's it? Oh, no, that's not how it works. And then they bring that back to the conversation with the chancellor, and the chancellor doesn't reply, won't answer the question. Well, the proposal, we're not due to give our report back to the Board of Governors until April. So basically, I don't have to tell you the details. Right? There was legislation that this is the stuff that drives me insane. And it's the kind of stuff that I found at the time extraordinarily discouraging. And it made me really like frustrated at all, right? About being able to say, my dark demons are the ones that are like, okay, fine. Let the shit burn. Right? It's that same feeling when I remember watching like Independence Day, right? You know, that feeling when the alien comes down, that big laser comes down, and the kind of White House goes. I remember seeing in a movie theater where people were actually cheering when that happened, right? Whatever, right? That's a very dark kind of thing, right? And I know that tendency of myself, right? You know, the kind of like, all right, fine. You don't believe me? Fine. Let it crash. Let it burn. Right? But that's like the absolute least enjoyable I told you shows I've ever had, right? The thing that I love is burned to the ground. Yeah, that's great. So anyways, so that's been part of the deal. So now this is when you've got what eventually drove, at least in my discussions with the folks about Lock Haven, again, we had them on Out to Coop Live last week, was, they couldn't get answers. And at the very least, what they want is answers. And yet what the chancellor wants to do is basically say that those are people that just don't understand, that they're stuck in the past. And because he's got that shiny persona, right? He's like Chancellor Woke Guy, right? Chancellor McDreamy. Because he's the one that kind of works with the big dogs and can put on a smile and performs well for the cameras. Although that's becoming less the case now, but because he's gotten traction. And what I was about to say is like, you know, he got this package of legislation passed last time that basically allowed him, that put him there, the ability to get rid, to destroy the state system. to make really significant fundamental like reforms that for like like faculty and my entire experience, when you start talking about act, like the act that founded, like, you know, the state system of higher education, we talk about actually reopening that up, you know, for different things, it would be like, no, you don't understand. They open that thing up, what they're going to do is X, Y, and Z. And so there was a real reason why, if, you know, to be very, very conscious about what's going on. Instead, we get this package of legislation that gets all supported by the Board of Governors that gives the chancellor the powers to do things that we would never give to anybody before. Because he's what, the smart guy? I don't know. So the state system has got a lot of, has got a serious, serious struggle ahead of it. Right. And frankly, I don't know where this goes. You know, I think that there's going to be, you know, ABSCUF president Jamie Martin came out and said that, you know, Chancellor Greenstein's comments about like dissolving the state system and introducing a package of legislation to dissolve the state system was unhelpful, destructive, and I agree with her. But I'll just go back to what's happening right here, at least from my vantage point, right? I mean, you could tell me that I'm wrong and I'm full of garbage. That's fine. But from my vantage point, this is about political strategy. Right? You introduce fear into a discussion in order to create compliant people. Right. This is an age old tactic. As somebody who started, you know, I cut my teeth in higher education in political science, right? Reading all, you know, whatever, The Art of War, like Machiavelli, all that kind of stuff. This is classic. You know, the other thing that's classic is that, you know, the divide and conquer. One of the things that that Chancellor Greenstein has been very good about is reaching out to particular groups of faculty. Right. Looking for the ones who are willing to play ball and work in them, right? And the sad thing about it is that, you know, and this is not just faculty, this is any workplace whatsoever. The sad thing about it is that when you've got a group of people that have been, say, taken for granted, right, have been not listened to, have been, you know, brushed aside for a long period of time, especially people like in higher education who actually have, you know, think that they've got something to say that's important, right? Have spent their lives studying kind of things in the world of knowledge. And so think that maybe we have something valuable to say. When you're told again and again that, no, you do not matter. Right? I've talked about this on the show before too, as well. That's my experience at Kutztown University right now. They could care less what I have to say, right? But what compensates for that very often, especially in the professional middle class, what they used as a way of to compensate for that is cultural access, right? Like the proverbial cocktail party. To have nice conversations and being included in the in crowd, right? And he's really good at that. He has enough people on the inside so he can legitimately say, oh, yeah, we had faculty input. Oh, yeah, yeah, we talked to students. You know, I mean, it's amazing to watch, really is. I mean, it's, you know, I give him a whole lot of credit for being a very skilled politician and manipulator. In particular, in this realm, he knows how to work the room. He knows where the bread is buttered, and there it is. So, this is the question I'll leave you with. And again, like if you have anything to say before we're kind of coming up at the end of the show, if you have anything that you want to kind of add to the conversation, you can do that now before we kind of close it out. Feel free, like I said, kind of feel free to interrupt. You know, I think we all got a choice to make at this point for those of us who, you know, care about public higher education and care about where we are in the state is like, you know, the chancellor, in a sense, has given us, you know, a few options. We can do the, you know, the fail fast method, right? We can just like wildly experiment and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. You know, when that Starship kind of misses its landing and explodes on the launching pad, you know, whoever happened to be there on that launching pad when it blew up, you know, it's just kind of like what it means to fail fast and innovate. Right? We can go that route. You know, that's the classic capitalism route, by the way. Creative destruction, right? Even Marx talked about that. It's creative destruction. Right? You got to destroy stuff. Right? I remember there's a, I'm sorry for this aside, but it was Edward Bernays. Okay. Edward Bernays is the self-appointed, say, founding father or grandfather or godfather, however you want to say it, of public relations. Okay. And he's got this book, you know, he's way well dead now, right? But he's got this book called On Propaganda or Propaganda, right? And it came out in, I want to say in the 40s, 30s. Maybe it was a little bit later than that even, but basically he came out of this a problem that the U.S. government was trying to solve, right? So on World War I, they found out that there was no way that they could nobody wanted to go to war, right? And matter of fact, there were riots in the streets, right? You had the kind of like biggest kind of like massive uprisings in New York City and different cities across the country. The draft riots, they were called at the time, of course, history that we don't learn. But, you know, suddenly the government's really, well, we're going to enter this war, but our people don't seem to want to go. So we've got to find a way of persuade them to go to war, right? Persuade them is worth it. These folks are like, you kidding me? We just left Europe because of this nonsense. You think we want to go back there and fight for them? You know, no, we refuse. And plus, there were a lot of socialists that were there. Anyways. So they established this thing called the Creel Commission, and the Creel Commission was designed to basically figure out a way of persuading people to go to war, right? To sign up, right? Not just to be drafted unwillingly, but to sign up and want to be part of it. And so Edward Bernays, Walter Lippmann is another one who's one of the kind of like, you know, kind of the one of those kind of like kingpins in journalism history. They were on this commission, right? And then what Edward Bernays realized is that, you know, they marshaled this and they came up with all these propaganda posters from World War I. If you see those famous propaganda posters from World War I, this is where they come from. And he realized that the same tools that they used to convince people to go to war, right, could be used in commerce, right? And he became convinced, or he just persuaded other people that he was convinced, however you want to look at it, that that's really what a democracy is about. The democracy is about the few persuading the many to do what the few want them to. Right? And he said one of the main things that you have to do in order to really significantly change things is you have to destroy tradition. Traditions, things like religion, things like, you know, growing up and living in the same town that your parents grew up in, about keeping with the family business, right? And again, let's be clear. There's a lot of traditions that deserve to be burnt to the ground, right? let's be clear. But he utilized that. You talked about that, you know, he called it the retrogressive force of tradition, right? Which is precisely what Chancellor Greenstein is doing right now. Those folks up in Lockhaven who don't want the merger, they're stuck in the past. They're standing in the way of progress. Of a future that's just out there, right? And so what Edward Bernays did is that, you know, he basically developed ways of strategies of how you manipulate people, right? And if you pick up that book, it's a really short book. It's worth reading. Just read the first couple chapters if you want. And you're going to see exactly what Greenstein is doing right now. It's basically written in those pages. 1921, I think the book came out. Now that I think about it. The same principle. You convince, you try to convince enough of those people to be part of this in-group. But one of the things you do is you play with this in-group, out-group stuff. So it's this massive thing in psychology. And, of course, he was the, I believe, son-in-law of Sigmund Freud. And he wrote in that book that propaganda, and this is before propaganda became associated with the Nazis. Okay, so this is like propaganda was being used, meaning just kind of public manipulation, public persuasion. And, you know... He basically said is about he that was his process. He says, well, if we can apply these principles of psychoanalysis to individual psyches, why can't we do this to the society as a whole? Walter Lippmann, who was also on that Creel Commission, said that all you need to do is you don't really have to care about why people make the choices that they do. You just need them to make this choice. So if you want to make sure that this system redesign gets passed through, you can use all sorts of means, and you don't care if this person is doing it because they believe in technological innovation, or this one's doing it because they're worried that they're going to lose their job, or this person's, you just don't care. As long as they're all checking box X as opposed to box Y, that's all that matters. So you utilize all these different ways of get them to check that box. You use fear, you use threat of their jobs, you use kind of ideological possibility in the future, you can use futurism. You can use racism. You can pit urban against rural, faculty against faculty, students against faculty, students against students. So how about that, right? It's got a long history of that in our country. So here we go. This is part of that game. This is part of that public persuasion. And, you know, Greenstein's working hard, the inside group, trying to get enough people to buy in so that he can say that here's my faculty. These are the good faculty. You can imagine where I am in that picture, by the way. You know, just, and I'm not the only one. I mean, there's lots of good faculty who've been fighting the good fight for a while and have been equally just kind of like ignored, pushed aside, politely nodded to. Or my favorite, our former... Our former provost was really good about this, is that when instead of just basically saying no to something, what her move was to kind of like say that she didn't have enough information, that she needed more information. And she just make you go do a whole lot more work. And you come back with all the work and it still wasn't enough, right? Because it was never really about getting to the solution. It was trying to wear you out until you're exhausted. And you've got nothing left, right? So we got our choices. We could just do what the chancellor says because he knows best. We don't need his answers. We don't even need him to respond to us. We just have to take him on his word because he's the smart guy. He's the guy from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's a Silicon Valley woke corporate dude. That's one option. We could just kind of fail fast, like I was saying before. Or maybe we can just kind of take on his threat and say, well, no, we're going to stick with what we're going to do. We're going to try to find another way through. So he'll just dissolve the state system. Now, Governor Wolf has come out and basically said that he will not support that. But things change, you know. You can create more crisis. People change their minds. You create a crisis. People are easier to manipulate. Milton Friedman understood that, right? Founding father of neoliberalism, market fundamentalism. So I'll leave you this with this one last piece. So we had about not getting answers to questions. About a week and a half ago, I had some information come to me and basically said, you know, I get these printouts from the State System of Higher Education, and they're kind of multiple award system-wide contracts, right? It's a list of all the contracts that are kind of either in effect now or about to go into effect when they expire and all that, which is kind of, this is a nice, you know, nice little kind of document to have on my desk. I was told about this because at some folks at one of the universities, right, who had apparently been talking to some people in different IT departments across the state, and several people were kind of concerned, right? And they said, what's going on? And basically, and folks are being said, hey, take a look at these contracts of these different organizations. You know, they're looking, we're looking at some organizations that we're considering that are for online instructional programs assistance. I mean, you mean like your IT departments? Is that what that is? You mean your distance learning departments? Right? And so I got this document, right? And it's like it says, okay, there's four that are being considered, right? There's the academic partnerships or Arizona State University or Everspring Incorporated or Noodle, right? There was four being considered. And the contract would basically go through 2025 at this point. And we had heard this, that they wanted to kind of go out and bring in and contract out IT departments, right? Contract out the distance ed folks. You know, all those people that busted their asses to make sure that when we were in the COVID lockdown, make sure that we had half a chance of delivering some sort of quality education to students. Those IT departments across this state that worked themselves to the bone, practically sleepless nights, to make sure that they got things up and running. Yeah, those people. Now they're the target of the next round of downsizing. So this just came in today. Everspring, selected by Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education to support digital growth across systems universities. Right? And I'll read this to you and then I'll kind of close up. So Everspring Incorporated, a leading provider of educational technology and services to universities seeking to build or expand their online capabilities, today announced a new partnership with Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Everspring will provide market research, instructional design support, outreach, enrollment services, and student support to PASHI in their current system redesign, an effort to digitally transform the network of universities. There it is. And so I got this contract, like I said, like a week ago, a couple weeks ago, maybe. Just get it flagged for me saying like, hey, this doesn't look good for our IT departments across the state. I don't know about you, but this is what it seems like to me. I said, that seems like about privatizing and eliminating IT things and consolidating things and centralizing all these operations of IT so that we lose local support. That's what it seems like to me. And now we've got these folks here. So let's see what happens. So when faculty are saying that they need answers to really specific questions, and the fact that the chancellor and his people have refused to give them, and then out of the blue, you find out that they knew all along and they were planning on contracting out these jobs. Who's the good actor here, right? You cannot bargain in good faith with people that are asking you to do work simply so they could extract your ideas when it's good for them and use you as a foil to enact their own vision of the world. This is what we should learn from what happens in Silicon Valley with these man boys out there. They have their vision of the world that because of their resources and power, they can enact it on the world and make it happen and make it real for themselves so that they can live in the world that they want. That is what is happening here. So whatever, we'll see how long he fools people. We'll see how long. All I have to say is that we have our other option. Our other option is to organize like there's no tomorrow. The other option is to make sure that we are sharing this information, that we are going to make, you know, we are supporting organizing efforts when they happened. And it's a message to the progressive community is that when you start to see organizations get off the ground that are beginning to do this, you help nurture them. You don't wreck them. This is a time to put pettiness aside. This is a time to put interpersonal politics aside and to say that to work and what it means to actually work in solidarity. It's what people like Naomi Klein have talked about. We need a kind of more muscular movement, one where solidarity is practiced, right? But you got to exercise those muscles in order to make them work. Solidarity is not just a phrase. You got to do it. And you decide, again, like the age-old labor zone, which side are you on? You know, the professional middle class has a particularly difficult time with this because they don't want to be on anybody's side. They want to assume that they're above ideological debates, conflict. They just want to, they want the win-win scenario, which again, Anand Giridharadas' book, Winners Take All, explodes that whole narrative. So check it out. So anyways, I appreciate y'all for kind of sticking with us tonight. Appreciate y'all for tuning in and your kind of attention to this issue, because, you know, we're certainly going to need it. On Friday this week, we're going to have kind of a regular news roundup with Sean Kitchen. And then, like I said, we won't have new shows next Monday night or the following Friday for that whole week. We'll be back on April, I think it's the 5th, I believe, for our Out to Coop Live once again. And I'm very excited to be bringing on for that show. I apologize to you, Cyril, right across the bat. Cyril Michalejko. I hope that's even close. Cyril Michalejko. Cyril is, I've been back and forth with Cyril kind of over the years here and there. He's moved around kind of quite a bit throughout the years. He's got his own kind of newsletter on Substack, right? You can just go Cyril Michalejko .substack.com, and that's Michalejko on Substack. But the big news here is that he just landed a column in the Courier Times, which is out here in Bucks County. And he had the first one that came out last week, I guess. And it was unapologetic kind of progressive left, right? And in the history of Bucks County, we've had this kind of right-wing kind of like nut job borderline conspiracy dude who has been given a column and has also been given a podcast by the newspaper now. But Cyril has broken in. We're going to have him on the show to talk a little bit about, say, ground-up kind of media activism and bringing progressive voice to Bucks County and networking folks. Oh, great. We got a call in from Corey. Let me say, great. You get just in time, Corey. Let me answer this for you. Hey, Corey Rock, what's up, man? Corey, can you hear me? Oh. Corey, if you want to try one, yeah, try again. Man, talk about coming in right under the gun, man. I'll wait for you. But so what I was saying, so Cyril's going to be, he'll be coming on the show, and he's got a new feature that's coming out, saying Meet a Progressive. So I'm going to be kind of plugging his stuff quite a bit, where he's going, he's interviewing progressives from around the state, and in some cases around the country. His first one came out this week. I know he's got another great piece coming out, came out yesterday, I think, maybe, or maybe today. No, I'm sorry. This Thursday it's coming out. So I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to let it kind of drop, and then I'm going to kind of plug the heck out of it to get it out there. And he'll be coming on the show to talk about that piece and kind of more broadly working on progressive media in kind of Bucks County in Pennsylvania, kind of writ large. The week following that, I've got another guest coming on. We're going to go back a little bit to some of the fracking issues. But what's been really encouraging, is that the number of people who have been kind of coming before and want to, you know, come on the show. So, you've heard me say it 1,000 times. If I could do this full time, if I could do this as my permanent job, I would do it in a heartbeat if I could make it work. But in the meantime, we can do what we can to kind of make sure that we expand, the show, make sure that we kind of can serve as a signal boost for kind of progressives and the left across the state. You know, you can do everything you can to help this show, becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/rcpress. You become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Or, you know, you can actually right now, I forgot to mention this at the top of the show. If you want to drop us a one-time contribution, you can go to paypal.me/rcpress, drop us a one-time contribution. Or if you're still sticking around here in the Podbean, you can also send us a little gift through that Podbean gift icon at the bottom of the page. Corey, you still there? I got a hard out in a couple minutes, so I'm just waiting to see if you get back in. No. All right, so Corey, if you do get back in, just kind of shoot me an email or something like that at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com, or catch up with me on Twitter at @rcpress, and kind of let me know what was on your mind, and we'll try to come back to it when we come back. Sorry, man, it would have been great to talk to you, hear what you had to say, but I appreciate it for everybody coming by and kind of being part of the show tonight. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Went longer than I wanted to tonight, but It's one of these things, you know. It's good for the psyche. This is my church. As Faithless used to say. All right. Thanks for stopping by, everybody. This is Kevin Hodiatter and founder of Ray Chicken. See ya!